Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. I have no idea what I'm going to say. I give so many of these Dhamma talks, right? You sort of give it a go. So, how's it going? Oh, okay, just start. So I was with the architect, and he came up with five schematics. We have a plan to build a structure behind the pines here, which will be a monk's kind of utility area, and so we'll have a library there and the shower rooms. One of the great joys of this monastery is getting up to the shower and finding no one in there. Scored. It really is. We rarely have schedules. Anyway. So the architect has created five plans. Lots of options. So obviously what my mind was going to was architectural planning. And that's just natural thought, isn't it? If you stimulate the mind towards some kind of, if you take intention, right, intention creates results. So my intentions are this afternoon around figuring out a good plan for a building, and so I have a lot of interaction with the architect, and it's interesting. And he's a very very nice man, and so then my mind moves to that, and that to me just seems just very natural, because how else could it be? You know, you make intentions and you create that. So that kind of thinking comes and goes. I don't think is really problematic. Where it's problematic is when it has a lot of power and emotion behind it, and the thoughts then drive the emotion onwards in the same negative, unskillful, heedless way. That's definitely where thought is problematic. So thought is a natural function of consciousness, and to use thought skillfully is a wonderful thing. To be a victim of thinking is prison, or worse, right? And to be able to move to no thought is a wonderful kind of freedom. So we need to understand thought, but we also need to understand the relationship of our mind and body, and that our emotional life is a very complex set of conditions that are both physical, they're based on thought. In fact, in the Pali you won't find a word called emotion. I don't think you do. We talk about mental formations, we call about sankharas, these compounded things. And when thought is not understood, and when thought becomes sort of dominant in the way we face life, and when thought is just driven by wrong assumptions, driven by habitual interpretations of life, then of course we're always in these same cycles of disappointment and inadequacy and just basically unhappiness. So getting out of all that is quite a challenge. Just again, talking with our builder friends there. I really enjoy them. One of them says he never stresses out. Say once a month, he says. The other one says 5-6 times a day. One says his wife is always stressing out. And I ask him, does she get irritated at him because he doesn't stress out? He says, yeah. So first of all, we're kind of constructed in different ways. We have different cultural conditioning. We have different familial conditioning. We have different gender conditioning. And then, if you take the Buddhist ideas on board, there's a whole, somehow karma comes into it, that. Then DNA, and so there's all kinds of things that create the particular personality we are right now. And so it's to judge that as being good or bad is not very helpful. I mean, it is as it is. Sure, maybe I wish I had nicer teeth, but there you go, I've got these teeth, or I wish I had this, or I wish I had that. That's not very, very helpful. Or comparing, to think that, well, that person's been practicing a year and they've already got all those attainments, and I've been at it for 20 years and I can barely see my breath, or that comparison doesn't work either. And so the sort of most important part of Buddhist, one of the most important parts of cultivation of right thinking in Buddhism is to first and foremost not believe in ego thinking. Because ego thinking or self thinking is based on the wrong understanding that this mind-body experience is somehow my personal, that I own it in some way, and that that's who I really am, that my emotions is who I am, and that my personal history is who I am, and that I am identification in the Buddhist way of thinking was a wrong assumption. We call it ignorance, not seeing clearly. So just take something like gender. I am a man, I am a woman. Now, obviously my consciousness functions through a man's body. And then my cultural conditioning, what a man is partially monastic, partially kind of Canadian upbringing in the 50s and 60s. And so there is kind of some sense of being of maleness, whatever that is. But that can be known. Like I can feel the kind of energy of a male 65-year-old body. It is as it is. I can't feel a 35-year-old feminine body. I don't know what that feels like. No idea. But I can feel this body, how it is. And to say that I am this body and I am a man is conventionally true. I am a 65-year-old man. But when I... What really is that? I am a man. Well, there is maleness, certainly. And maleness has a way of functioning. There is 65-year-oldness, and that has a way of functioning. And that I can be aware of. But to say that I am that, to me, that's not accurate, because it's never really the same. It's changing, it's culturally conditioned, it's shifting around. So when we're talking about it, earlier I was saying there's like two ways of look, there's two streams of teaching, say, in Buddhism. You have the social philosophy, and then you have the way of observing the phenomenon of consciousness. So social philosophy, I am a man, hence I can ordain as a monk. I can't ordain as a nun. And so that works. But then in observing the phenomenon of the mind, the teaching is to look at the very feeling of being male. What is that like? How does it affect? And then I observe maleness. Maleness reacts in a certain way to women, reacts in a certain way to men, reacts in a certain way to older women, younger women. Yeah, it's just maleness does that. Right? And if I get that perspective, then I see, oh, that's the dharma of maleness. And that's very freeing. Whereas the sense of I am 65 years old, true, but as an identity, that's not really why would I want to take that identity? I am 65 years old. There is 65-year-oldness, and it has certain ramifications that I've got to really take care of my knees now, and I should be doing more yoga and all that business. But I can know stiffness. I can know a lack of vitality. I can know the feeling of like being frustrated with my voice now because my voice is starting to pack in, and so on and so forth. And that's just the nature of 65-year-oldness. And as long as I have that perspective of this changing experience of being human, then I'm always in the perspective of awareness, knowing dharma. And that's where we find freedom. And if the thinking is in that way, so if the, like now, when I do the chanting, my voice keeps kind of falling apart, and I find that quite annoying. Because I like chanting, I like to lead chanting. So my practice now is just noticing as I'm chanting that the sense of kind of just a little bit of frustration or annoyance. And that I can know that this changing condition of throat problem creates a certain dislike, craving, not liking it, and then that creates a reaction of kind of restless annoyance. As long as I keep aware of that, then my mind is always free. And then I work through the annoyance and then I die. It's going to happen. And this is just, this is nothing compared to what's coming. But you see what I mean? I'm not taking it personally. I'm not being foolish. I see a doctor and do all that kind of business. But this is just what bodies do. When they're 65 years old, they function in this way. When they're 30 years old, they function a different way. And so seeing the dharma of aging, say, seeing the dharma of gender, understanding the dharma of maleness or femaleness or whatever. So then issues, issues like gay or straight or whatever, they're not really issues anymore in dharma. Whatever way this mind-body responds to other mind-bodies, so that's just its way. It's neither good nor bad. What's more important is moral precepts, honesty, not hurting others, not hurting yourself, sobriety, da-da-da-da-da, those kinds of things. Those are really important. But preferences or whatever, they're just conditioned for various reasons. They're neither good nor bad. So sometimes those issues that we have in culture, they are important at a social level, but at the dharma level, none of those are really skillful identities. They're important socially, but dharmically, you don't want to take an identity of being anything. There was that lovely Ajahn Cha was invited up to Manjushri Institute, which was in Cumbria, I think, when we were down in Chithurst. And Manjushri Institute was a big Tibetan scene, which was just kind of getting going. They were renovating this old mansion. And there was some kind of competitive energy because they were Mahayana Tibetan and we were Theravada or Hinayana. So the kind of perception of us that we were the lesser vehicle. And the language in Buddhism is kind of strange because in Theravada Buddhism, an arahant is someone who has attained the highest realization. But sometimes in the Mahayana tradition, an arahant is still someone who has some bit of selfishness going on. So a bodhisattva is a kind of higher state. So these are two different paradigms working, but people kind of overlap them and they get confused. So Ajahn Chah went up to Manjushri and he had kind of heard about this going on. And I think he had read about Mahakasapa, but he took a flower. And he did a Mahayana on them. He just held a flower. And they totally fell in love with him. But what he said there, he said, don't be a bodhisattva, don't be an arahant. If you're anything, you'll suffer. Like, don't take an identity with anything. So, and when you're talking, like, don't be a man or don't be a woman, don't be anything, on a social level, it doesn't make any sense at all. It just seems ridiculous. But you can see how you know, to find freedom in this incarnation is to see this whole structure as a part of nature, something which is born, develops, decays, and dies. And that this is true of our emotional conditioning and our cultural conditioning, and not to take it personally. And that's really, as I said, I think earlier, that's the entry point into true Buddhist practice, the sense of knowing this mind-body experience as Dharma rather than me and mine. So thoughts which are heavily invested with me and mine, those are the really the most pernicious and dangerous. So like thoughts of just thinking about this structure, say. Those are kind of quite just innocent thoughts, aren't they? Just they're quite neutral. But let's say I perceive someone from a state of anger, and then I take that state of anger, and I said, they shouldn't be that way. That's wrong. You know, they're terrible for being that way. I'm never going to forgive them. That's a whole different kind of thinking, and that thinking is both driven by aversion, but also driven by self-view. Me and them, me and them, me and them, me and them. And that's very destructive, fraught with suffering, and deepens the whole sense of ignorance and ego in human consciousness. So that kind of language, that kind of thinking, whenever it comes up, the training is don't believe it. So that, you know, in looking at how we get preoccupied with thought, do observe, are the preoccupations very self-oriented? So are they like very, let's say, something which is very self-judgmental and self-critical? Just kind of always just lashing out at yourself. You do something and the mind immediately says you did it wrong, you should have done it different. You're at some meeting or something and you immediately you go away and you think, oh, I blew that, I didn't get that right. The mind just continually coming to a sort of a negative interpretation of life with a strong sense of self. That's different than, let's say, I see that maybe the gutters in the main house are leaking and then, okay, we should do that this year. We should fix those gutters. That's critical thinking, but it's not invested with me and mine. Certainly, it's me thinking about the gutters and my responsibilities in the monastery, but it's a whole different kettle of fish, isn't it? So these this what we call Sakaya Ditti, or personality view, that we need to awaken to. And the buzzword, the watchword is awaken to rather than get rid of. And when strong self-making, I-making language is manifesting, then what will also be happening will be strong physical tensions in the body. They're very, very much that way. Just take a gross example. If you're really angry at someone, you feel it all over your body. Your thoughts will be pummeling the person, and your body will be in tension, fear, greed, or whatever. So there's a sort of there's a kind of necessity, first of all, to awaken to the self-thinking, and then there's a necessity of enduring the upheaval that this self-thinking is coming from some situation, some loss, some betrayal, some disappointment, some kind of cultural, familial conditioning that you have, wherever it's coming from. And so there's both the awakening to this as it is, and then there's what we call purification. And purification takes place when these upwellings, or kind of, we call them asavas or anusayas, these kind of latent tendencies which get triggered, they come rushing up into the mind. And now, rather than grasping them with eye thinking, we begin to witness to them as tensions, and they're very uncomfortable. They're very hard to bear with. But as we become fully conscious of that physically, their energy then is no longer fueled in a negative way. Where we feel these things is when we take on these ego thoughts. So if I've been betrayed by someone, and I thought we were okay, and then that person, I find out they betrayed me in a really, maybe you can rip me off, you know, like maybe I trust someone, and then they rip me off and I lose $10,000 or whatever on some contract, building contract, and then I trusted them, and that trust is broken. Then what comes up into the mind is quite painful. It's physically, I feel it, and anger comes up, and my whole world is kind of spun around like a tsunami. So what to do about that? Well, if I have the patience and mindfulness and probably situation right there to bear with the fire going through me, to bear with the disappointment and the betrayal, and not let it go to the self-thinking, then, and I process it right there, I'm going to have a lot less work tomorrow. It'll still come up tomorrow. I mean, if I deal with it right there as it comes up, then on the third day I'll have less work, and the fourth day I'll have less work, and it'll work its way out very quickly. But if I don't have the mindfulness and understanding, and I somehow don't deal with it, then it kind of lodges in me, might create a certain kind of personality, might become bitter, mistrusting, cynical. I might do things like really viciously hate the person and then pursue that hatred and become very hateful and so on and so forth. Then that compounds the problem. And as I compound the problem, my ego identity gets very much caught up into that. And then if ever I stop to look at it, it's going to be even harder work. So the more quickly we can attend to these upwellings, the more free we're going to be. And you can see that requires a lot of patience. You have to be very, very, very attentive, but very, very patient as these things kind of go through you. But as they go through and we don't fuel, and that's very much one of the images you have around the enlightenment, is that the fuel of ignorance is no longer, like the fires of ignorance are no longer stoked with fuel, and the mind is cooled. So any kind of fear, say, anger, greed, self-doubt, all that, the more I can know it as a dharmic mood, as a kind of condition in the mind, the less I feed it with self-thinking, that self-thinking is the fuel. Think about someone who you, like let's say there's someone on the retreat who has a kind of behavioral habit which is not immoral, but is annoying to you. Okay? I know it never happens. So, there's the person, there's the behavior, there's the negative feeling because of that you don't like it. Somehow it offends you, it makes you uncomfortable, disturbs you. Now when that arises, the person's behavior, what arises, it's unpleasant to your mind. And because it's unpleasant, you want to change it. And the way you can change it is by basically wiping them off the face of the earth. In other words, hating them. In other words, go away, don't be like that. Go away, you shouldn't be like that. You shouldn't be like that. You shouldn't be like that. So that's called hatred. And then, if you're very attentive, and if you use that, and that's why retreats are important for that kind of thing, if you're very attentive, you use that person's behavior to sharpen your awareness. You really pick that up as a kind of theme, and you're in the dining hall or you're in the meditation hall, and you keep watching how with this behavior there's this reaction, with this behavior, and you remain attentive and available. Well, that's hard to do, right? But if you do that, what you walk away from it with a certain freedom, because you haven't attached, you haven't grasped. If the behavior you're not aware, right, what happens? Well, person behaves in a certain way, and then you start to believe in your hatred. Right? So you believe they shouldn't be that way. They shouldn't be that way. And then if you do that enough, that's the only thing you'll notice about them. The only thing you notice is that their nose is on crooked. And every time you see them, look at the nose. Look at their nose. Wrong, they're wrong. And your mind will begin to perceive them in a very monochromatic way, in a very unidirectional way. You'll only see this negative thing in them. And then because you only see that, you'll perpetuate the perception that they're at fault and that they shouldn't be that way. And you can build up a whole life around those misperceptions around yourself or others. And that will all be with self-view, won't it? You mean to really, like let's say hatred, to really hate something, you have to keep bringing up into consciousness that aspect of the person which you find displeasing. You have to remember that. If you just watch that displeasing aspect, you pay attention to it and don't feed it, it goes to neutrality. The other way too, you might get, like, what do they talk about? Vipassana romances. I suspect we're all too old for that, but but I've heard tapes about it. There was someone in the monastery in Wellington who was on a long IMS retreat. And the managers came and told this person, you know, someone on the retreat has accused you of following them around. And the guy was like, totally, what? Am I what? So the rest of the retreat, he was worried that this person thought that he was following her around. At the end of the retreat, there was nothing. It was just all perceptions, just the mind created something which was totally not there. It's just total delusion. So delusion arises from the self-view. It's this kind of self-thinking. So whether it, or maybe self-disparagement, say, that's a classic example where you focus on one aspect of your character, which you perceive to be faulty, and you narrow on that, and you keep perceiving and interpreting that way, and then you keep whacking yourself. No, you know, good, you shouldn't have done that, you shouldn't have done that. And someone else says to you, actually, you know, no, you know, thanks, you're really a generous person. No, I'm not, you don't really know me. And you just go back to that perception, I'm hopeless, I'm hopeless, I'm hopeless. You know, yeah, you did that really well. No, I didn't. You can't accept praise. You're totally wrong. Yeah, but I just saw it. So that's an interesting thing to watch. If someone praises you, do you just dismiss it? What's that about? It's arrogant to accept praise. No, I'm not. So that you kind of begin to watch how self-view arises in the mind. Someone blames you. So if you're into self-disparagement and you get blamed, you say, you're totally right. Yeah, you're right. But if you're not into that, maybe you get totally defensive. I saw you do something else. You did the same thing yesterday. You know, kind of. So praise and blame. You begin to kind of, let's say someone is into whatever, and you watch how that feels. So maybe praise, you like it, usually, you like it, or you feel, no, it's not right. And just as how self-view arises, how self-feeling arises, you begin to just know that that's the dharma of self. Self arises this way, that way. And no longer believe in it. No longer take that as your identity. Then your identity becomes awareness. And that's a much, much better identity to have. We have a word, anusaya and asava. Anusaya is what we call latent tendency. It's a tendency which, when it gets triggered, comes to the surface. So, like Ajahn Chah would say, why do you always work with the monks you like? Why don't you work with the monks you dislike? Of course, I'm not going to work with the monk I dislike. And what he was encouraging us was not to have a fight, but to actually look at like when someone irritates me, to be really be with that, to be with that, and not be a victim of that. And you can see how that would be very, very powerful, very powerful. And then if you start to actually introduce perceptions which are unifying. Because these perceptions like anger, fear, greed, they're the alienating energies, aren't they? Division, you're different than me, you shouldn't be like that, I shouldn't be like that. They divide, they separate, they alienate, they make us lonely. But then we can also bring up perceptions and ideas which bring us together, and these are the things that take us away from ego consciousness, from ego thought. So like if you just think about the golden rule, do unto others as you would have done unto you. Don't do things to others that you don't want done to you. Metta practice, that's what goodwill practice is about. If I feel like if someone insults me and I find it painful, someone abuses me and find it painful, I can hate them, sure. And I can say, get off my case. They say, you can't do that, but whatever. But also I can contemplate that when someone speaks to me like that, that's really painful, and I'm not going to do that to others. Now that unifies me with other people. Just as you don't like pain, just as I don't like pain, you don't like pain. Just as I want to be happy, you want to be happy. Those are unifying perceptions. Whereas like aversion, obviously, is very, 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 very divisive, alienating and lonely. So the more we bring up like perceptions of you and I are brothers and sisters in old age, sickness and death. It's one of the ways that The Thai teachers talk about it. You and I are brothers and sisters in old age, sickness and death. Or, you know, we've been wandering so long in samsara that we've all been brothers and sisters and fathers and mothers and cousins and aunts many times before. You know, all these different sort of narrative ways of freeing us from this awful alienation, you know, the awful kind of fearfulness that we have, or loneliness that we have, or, you know, sense of like doubt around each other, or resentment of each other, all of these very lonely states of mind, very painful states of mind. But the possibility of like silent compassion is very, very real. It's not, you know, it's not out of our reach. And I think I think we're made for that myself. I think we're made for enlightenment. I think that is our destiny. I mean, I like to look at it that kind of optimistic way. And certainly the Buddha's realization was that there is this deep, deep, deep peace and compassion in possible in consciousness, and it can be accessed, it can be realized, it can be known. And the pathway is fairly arduous. It takes quite a bit of work. But really, what else are you going to do? What else is there to do? Make a lot of money? Well, none of us are into that. Just enough. So to kind of dedicate this life to that, it's very, very wholesome, very, very inspiring kind of thing to do. And then just be patient with the self-views that come up, but don't believe them. You know, the self-views that come up, don't believe it anymore. Viradhamma, you're great, fine. Viradhamma, you're rotten, fine. It's just a thought. I am enlightened, fine. I'm not enlightened, fine. I'm almost enlightened, fine. Don't be an arahant, fine. Don't be a bodhisattva, you know. Don't take any identity at all. And then there is clarity, there is awareness. And awareness is really, the more we abide as that, we find that's where our real freedom is. Okay, I'll leave that for your reflection.